Judges chapter 17. This is the beginning of, well, I don't know that it's the beginning of the downhill part of Judges. If you've gone through Judges with us, you know the whole thing's been downhill. It's not a lot of good stuff. Every once in a while, when a judge is alive, people, the Israelites, seem to follow after God. But the majority of the book spends them, sees them being in gross apostasy. And the next, four or five chapters of Judges, which we'll cover tonight and next Thursday night, are just bad stuff going on all over the place. And so we will see what we can glean out of these things, positive and negative. In chapter 17, verse 1, the writer of Judges tells us, "Now there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah." The hill country of Ephraim, if you look at a map of Israel, hopefully in the beginning, if you have a study Bible or a Bible with maps, it should have around the beginning of the book of Joshua, hopefully we'll have a map that tells you the different tribes and where they got land allotted to them. This was the hill country of Ephraim. The sons of Joseph were Manasseh and Ephraim. Remember, Manasseh spent half of the tribe of Manasseh stayed on the wrong side of the Jordan. So we've got one and a half tribes here that kind of got stuck. Not stuck. They inherited the land right in the middle of Israel there. It's kind of just kind of smack in the middle there. And when they inherited this, when half tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Ephraim inherited this land, there was a source of division or complaint here that they said, well, this land is too small. You know, we're seeing all these other tribes get this great land with these open farm pastures and cities that we've driven these Canaanites out of, and they've inherited these big cities, and they're saying, well, we don't have this big pasture land. We don't have these great cities that we've inherited. Our land ain't that good. And we read about that back in Joshua 17 when they said, "Why have you given me only one lot and one portion for an inheritance, since I am a numerous people whom the Lord has thus far blessed?" And Joshua said to them, if you are a numerous people, go up to the forest and clear a place for yourself. So they were saying, well, it's not that it's not big enough. It's just that there's not enough open things. I mean, we'd have to cut down a bunch of trees to make it farmland. Well, go cut down some trees. You know, what are you complaining to me for? Go cut down some trees. And so he said, clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and of the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you. And the sons of Joseph said, well, the hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who live in the valley land have chariots of iron, both those who are in Beth Shean and its towns, and those who are in the valley of Jezreel. And Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, you are a numerous people and have great power. You shall not have one lot only, but the hill country shall be yours, for though it is a forest, you shall clear it. And to its farthest borders it shall be yours, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron, and though they are strong. So Joshua's response to this is that, okay, the land's not too small, it's just got some work involved in it. God hasn't handed it to you on a silver platter, you've got to fight in faith, basically. You need to go and have faith in God, trust the Lord that He is going to battle your enemies for you, but you need to step out in faith. You can't just sit on your easy chair and say, well, God, when the land's ready, just let me know. As most things in the Christian life are, so was this, that we actually had to step out and see something done, even though it looked like it was going to be a lot of work. So all they had to do was trust the Lord, drive out the Canaanites, cut down some trees, and they're good to go. The land was conquered. Joshua's inheritance, you might remember, was also in this area, in the hill country of Ephraim. And now we learn, getting back to Judges 17, we learned that there in the hill country of Ephraim, there's this guy named Micah. He's not a good guy. I mean, as guys go in the Bible, he's not that great of a guy. And he's not all that edifying. He's not edifying to us, to his family, anything. And we can see this in verse 2. He said to his mother, hey, Mom, the 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, you know, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me. I took it. And his mother said, blessed be my son by the Lord. This is a really flaky mom. I just kind of picture, have you ever met like almost like a television mom who's just so ditzy beyond belief. Oh, that's okay. Oh, that's all right. You know, no clue what punishment means. No clue what discipline means. Just, oh, whatever's okay, whatever. That's kind of how I picture his mom. His mom's kind of not all there, I guess. What had happened was she had 1,100 pieces of silver. This is no small amount. We're going to see in a little bit that a priest is hired full time for 10 pieces of silver a year. So this is a lot of money. This is 110 years of his wages. And it was, I guess she had it in, kept in the cookie jar or whatever, and Micah took it. He stole it. And when she discovered it was stolen, she started to pray a curse. I get that these people are very religious as we look at this story. They have no clue who God is really, but they're very religious in regards to God. And so she says, oh, Lord, may whoever took my 1,100 pieces of silver be accursed. Let just smite them with boils or whatever, you know. And her son heard this and started getting nervous because he was somewhat religious too. And he said, Mom, I took it because, you know, I don't want to be cursed. And so she blessed him instead. Oh, great. Oh, the son, that's awesome. And he then returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, and his mother said, I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. You see the name of Yahweh here being used here, the Lord himself, and in the same breath, I'm going to make the Lord an idol. I'm going to make a graven image and a molten image. Now, therefore, I will return them to you. So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith, who made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. Micah's mom, so thankful to get her money back, that she dedicated 200 pieces of silver to be molded or to pay to make these images unto the Lord. We're talking about the real Lord here, but we're not talking about a proper form of worship, obviously. You would think that she would have taken them to the tabernacle, which was in Shiloh, not too far away, about 2 hours' walk. You would think that, oh, you know, I'm going to dedicate this to the Lord. Hey, son, run over to the temple and deposit that in the treasury, would you? No, she gave it to the silversmith to make idols. A graven image, which is an idol that's carved out of stone or out of wood, and a molten image where they melt down metal, they make the metal molten, and pour it into a cast. That's why they call it a molten image. They pour it into a cast, and so you've got this metal image, a molten image, and you have this hand-carved carved image. So he's got these two idols now to the Lord. This is a bad time. It's a bad time in Israel's history. Of course, the law of God was clear. In Leviticus 26, it said, you shall not make for yourselves idols, nor shall you set up for yourselves an image or a sacred pillar, nor shall you place a figured stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God. So this is the pitiful situation in this house. You've got a son who steals. You've got a mother who has no clear about punishment or righteousness. You've got an entire family of superstitious idolaters who think that they're pleasing to the Lord. So this is where they're at, and they don't know that anything's wrong. And in verse 5, the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. This just gets worse and worse and worse. He makes this shrine. It's a bayith, and that means house. Back in verse 4, when it says the house of Micah, that's the bayith of Micah. Well, now he's made a house for his idols. You know, I kind of picture he made a little manger scene for his idols or whatever. Maybe the idols were bigger. Maybe he gave them a whole room. But he made a house for his idols in his house. And he's like, well, you know, I really can't have a temple unless I have a priest. So I'll make an ephod. Remember, the ephod was that apron thing that the high priest wore. So I'll make an ephod, and I need a priest. Son, you look like a priest. Let's put the ephod on you, and you can be my priest. So he made his own gods. He made his own priest. This is a God he can relate to, isn't it? This is a God that he could really worship. You know, a God that you can buy, that you can build a little house for, that you can consecrate your son to be a priest for. There you go. sorry situation. So he made a house for the priest, or not for the priest, a house for these idols. And he made more household idols, you see, in addition to the ephod. So now he's getting a little collection going here. He's got the molten image, the graven image, and even more idols. And, you know, idolatry to me is just incomprehensible. I mean, it's hard to know how to put it into words. And it's so ludicrous sometimes that very often when we teach through the Bible, we'll talk about the idols in our lives. You know, celebrities become idols to people, and television becomes an idol, or your boat or your jet ski becomes an idol. But idolatry in its purest, simplest form is, I made this, and now I'm using it to represent God, and I'm worshiping it. And when you think about it, that is so incredibly ridiculous, and you think, how could any intelligent person really do this? But the Catholic Church is full of idolatry. Religions around the world of very educated people are full of idolatry. The New Agers are into idolatry. They don't really look at it as idolatry, but I remember being in high school and wearing a crystal of obsidian that somebody told me it would draw out the negative energy out of my life. Didn't work. You know, and so we have these things that we ascribe power to, you know, that somehow they are, there's like this, it represents God to us. Now, the Lord has, not only has he condemned idolatry and said, don't do it, don't make a graven image, don't make a statue of my mom and kiss its feet, you know, don't make a statue of her husband and offer incense to it, don't make a statue of my apostles, don't do this. See, it's even in the church. It's not just, oh, look at those pagan nations. Even the church has incorporated idolatry with its icons. God hasn't just forbidden it. He's tried to explain to us how incredibly ludicrous it is. And through Isaiah, he said, you know, I want you to consider a guy, you know. And a guy goes out and he cuts down a tree, and he shapes wood. He extends a measuring line. He outlines it with red chalk. You know, he's a cabinet maker. He's a carpenter. He's a boat carver, whatever he is, right? He works with it and planes it and outlines it with a compass and makes it like the form of a man, like the beauty of a man, so that it may sit in a house. So here, I'm a woodworker, you know, I decide, well, I'm kind of tired of making dressers and things, and so I just carve up the shape of a man, and it can sit in my house. Surely he cuts cedars for himself, and he takes a cypress or an oak and raises it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a fir, and the rain makes it grow. Then it becomes something for a man to burn. So he takes one of them and warms himself. He also makes a fire to bake bread. So God is talking about the practicality of wood. You plant a tree, it grows up, you cut it down, you warm yourself with it, you cook some bread with it. You know, wood's a good thing. Except he says, he takes one of them, warms himself, he also makes fire to bake bread. He also makes a god and worships it. He makes it a graven image and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over this half he eats meat as he roasts a roast and is satisfied. He also warms himself and says, I'm warm, I have seen the fire. But the rest of it he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it and worships. He also prays to it and says, deliver me, for thou art my God. They do not know, nor do they understand, for he has smeared over their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot comprehend. And no one recalls, nor is there knowledge or understanding to say, I have burned half of it in the fire, and also have baked bread over its coals. I roast meat and eat it. Then I make the rest of it into an abomination. I fall down before a block of wood. Isn't it ludicrous to think about cutting down a tree, and you burn half of it, and the other half is your God? How do you know you didn't burn the wrong half? I mean, really. We take marble, a little more sophisticated, a little more into art now, you know, we take marble and we make a statue of Joseph or the Virgin Mary or St. John the Divine or whatever. We make a statue of it. It's like, wait a second, this came out of the ground. This could have just as easily been your bathroom tile, really. It could have been the tile that you stand on in front of the toilet. But instead, you formed it into the shape of a woman or a man, and you pray to it. Why not just pray to your bathroom tile? God says, do you see how stupid this is, people? Do you understand this? Idolatry in its basest form, forgetting about the television and the jet ski and everything else, in its basest form, intelligent people get stupid about it. And they look at it and they say, you are my God. Incredible. Micah obviously didn't stop at the idolatry. He wanted a priest, made the ephod. He made his son the high priest. So now he's got a priest to go with his house of idols. And verse 6 kind of sums up the rest of this book. In those days, there was no king in Israel, but every man did what was right in his own eyes. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Much as this is a summation of the rest of the book of Judges, it is also a summation of our own country today. Everybody doing what's right in their own eyes. We'd like to think that's not true, but in reality it is. And, you know, we could talk for hours about the justice system, which is no justice. It's about which lawyer can come up with the best loophole to get this guy off. It's no justice. We could talk about right and wrong, but believe it or not, the generation that was born after most of us has been taught that there is no right and wrong. And it's very devious how they've been taught this. It's got a nice name. It's got moral relativism. You see, your morals aren't the same as my morals. Am I wrong? Are you wrong? Which one of us is wrong? Let's tell a story. Let's ask a question in a college class. You have an old lady and a little boy and a doctor, and they've all survived a shipwreck. And there's a lifeboat, but it'll only hold two people. Three people, it'll sink. And so you get to make the decision. Which one goes? The little boy, the old woman, or the doctor? Is there a right answer? Of course not. You see, there's no right and wrong. You see, they're telling our high school students and they're telling our college students that there is no right and wrong. And they use devious examples like that to illustrate how everything is gray. And there's no right and there is no wrong. It's just what you believe, how you feel about it. You see, there's no God. And so the concept of a God who knows what right and wrong is, feels love towards this and hatred towards this, that's so archaic, that's so Neanderthal. And so you need to determine your own morals. You need to determine what's right and wrong for you. You need to do what's right in your own eyes. And if you don't believe our kids are learning that, talk to your kids about right and wrong. Talk to your kids about what they're learning as early as preschool, as early as third grade, and into college. This is what they're learning. This is what they're being taught across the board. In philosophy classes, history classes, every class, they're learning this stuff. Every man doing what's right in his own eyes. And this is where we come to. And so as we read the book of Judges, understand that this is not something that happened way back then, that these terrible things. No, these terrible things happen now because here is Micah and his family calling on the name of the Lord and yet doing what's right in their own eyes. And I dare say that you know Christian families just like this, who claim the name of the Lord, who have a cross on their wall or a fish on their car, but they do what's right in their own eyes. And so we are very relatable to this. We understand. Now, when we do what's right in our own eyes, when we do what we think is right instead of what God says is right, the proverb comes true. There is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Twice in Proverbs, it says that. First time in Proverbs 14:12. There's a way which seems right to a man, but the end is the way of death. And when everyone is doing what's right in their own eyes, you can rest assured that that society is headed towards destruction. Short of repentance and turning to God, there is no hope. It's only a matter of time. And you can look at history. You can look at the Roman Empire and everything else throughout all of history. When a nation does that, they are destroyed. Verse 7. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite. And he was staying there. Then the man departed from the city, from Bethlehem in Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. Now, Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah. If you look up the word Bethlehem in the Bible, you will find that there's actually two cities named Bethlehem. One was in the inheritance of the land of Judah, which was in the area of Ephrath. And there was another one in the inheritance of Zebulun, which is named once or twice in the Bible. The Bethlehem, where it's explained here that the Bethlehem that this Levite guy is from Bethlehem, Judah. Also, because it's part of Ephrath, or kind of in the county of Ephrath, it's called Bethlehem Ephrathah. And that was, interestingly enough, the city where Jesus was born and was prophesied to be born by another guy named Micah. Not this guy named Micah. I'm glad that this guy wasn't the prophet. But later on, in the book of Micah, the prophet Micah wrote, "But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, for from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity." Micah the prophet, not Micah the idolater, Micah the prophet was the one who prophesied that Jesus, the Messiah, the one who was eternal from eternity past, he had no age. Though he was born as a baby, he was infinitely old. Figure that out. That he would be born in Bethlehem, not the Bethlehem in Judah, but Bethlehem Ephrathah, the one in, did I say Zebulun? No, what, you know what I'm saying. Not the one in Zebulun, the one in Judah, Bethlehem Ephrathah. So the Micah of our story meets this traveling Levite from Bethlehem. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to stay wherever I might find a place." Micah then said to him, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance." So the Levite went in, and the Levite agreed to live with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as a priest." So you just put the little plastic thing on the dashboard of your car. You know, I know the Lord's going to bless me now. I know I've got a Levite in the house. It gets worse and worse. The more religion gets put into Micah's life, the worse it gets. You know, his son probably, whether he wasn't doing as good of a job or just the idea of, "Yeah, my son's an okay priest, but a Levite, now that's a priest. Now God's going to bless my idolatrous house here. And now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing as I have a Levite as a priest." Now, this Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, remember that not every Levite was a priest. See, we remember that the tribe of Levi, that's where the priests came from. But not every Levite was a priest. You had to be a descendant of Levi to be a priest. I think I just said this. But not every descendant of Levi was a priest. Remember, Levi had three sons. He had Kohath, Gershon, and Merari. Those were his three sons. And of those three sons, three clans came into the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi was divided into the Kohathites, the Gershonites, and the Merariites, I think they were called. Anyway, So the Kohathites were the ones that did all the work in the temple. They did all the work in the tabernacle. They were the ones that carried the stuff and set things up and did all this stuff. And of the Kohathites, it was only the sons of Aaron that were priests. So remember, here's the tribe of Levi. It's divided into three sections. The Kohathites were the ones that worked in the tabernacle. And of the Kohathites, there was that the sons of Aaron specifically who were priests. So just because you were a Levite doesn't mean that you're a priest. But he figures, hey, better a Levite than my son. You know, my son's not a Levite. He's an Ephraimite. Now, he's from Bethlehem, Judah, or Bethlehem in Judah. And so what that tells us is that we can trace back and find out, okay, remember, the Levites didn't have a portion of the land, that God was their portion, but God gave them 49 cities sprinkled throughout the land in each one of these tribes' inheritance or plots of land. And so as you plot these things out, when the lot fell to the Kohathites, when the Kohathites, that section of the tribe of Levi, when they got their land, they were the ones that settled in Judah. And so we see that in Joshua 21, the lot came out for the families of the Kohathites, and the sons of Aaron, the priest, who were of the Levites, received 13 cities by lot from the tribe of Judah and from the tribe of the Simeonites and from the tribe of Benjamin. We read this in Joshua 21. And the rest of the sons of Kohath received 10 cities by lot from the families of the tribe of Ephraim and from the tribe of Dan and from the half-tribe of Manasseh. So the Kohathites were the ones that settled in the land of Judah. So we know that this guy is a Kohathite. He's close. Okay, he's in there. He seems to be in that family tree, but we don't know for sure whether he is a priest or not. We know he's probably a Kohathite, but we don't know if he's specifically a son of Aaron. And in fact, there's going to be a surprise ending to our story at the end of chapter 18. Don't read ahead. You probably won't figure it out until we get there. But the surprise ending at the story will tell us exactly his genealogy, and it will tell us basically close but no cigar. Micah decides that having this guy, son of Aaron or not, he's a Levite, right? And better a Levite than my son to be the priest. Now God's going to bless me. Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing as I have a Levite as priest. And again, we see a complete lack of knowledge regarding God's ways. You know, there seems to be a desire in Micah's heart to worship God, but it's on his terms. It's not in accordance with knowledge. It's in accordance with, well, I know God's the right God, and so I'll just do what I think is right to worship God. Well, a Levite priest, that's got to be good. Well, I made a house for him, and I made some idols that represent him. But of course, idols are forbidden by God. This Levite was not in the place. Even if he was a priest, he should have been serving in Shiloh, where the tabernacle was. And this whole situation is grieving to God. It's none of this is pleasing to God. It's bumming him out. And a lot of people are under the impression, they think, well, is God really not content with people's hearts that desire to worship him but do it wrong? Or is it really all that important to do things exactly the way they are in the Bible? Or is God really that much of a stickler to his own way? And the answer to all those questions is yes. Yes, absolutely, God is a stickler. God is not blessed by somebody who goes, oh, I think I'll worship God, but does it in an idolatrous way. When somebody disregards what the Bible says, well, what if they don't know what the Bible says? Well, God's going, man, I printed billions of those books. I printed them in all these different languages, and you probably got 10 in your house. You got no excuse for not reading it. I mean, I went to the trouble of writing it. The least you could do is read it. And, well, does God really hold me accountable for that lack of knowledge? Absolutely. Absolutely. And the Bible, over and over, God says, you know what? My people, he told the prophets, Isaiah 5:13, he said, my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge. And their honorable men are famished, and their multitude is parched with thirst. To Hosea, in Hosea 4:6, he said, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. The destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD, when the armies of Titus Vespasian came in and destroyed Jerusalem, That was because of the Jews' lack of knowledge. Remember, Jesus was prophesied by the angel Gabriel to the prophet Daniel. Count the days from the going forth of the decree to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. It's going to be 173,880 days until Messiah the Prince comes in. And if they had just marked their calendars, if they had just been checking them off, okay, 1, 2, 3, up to 173,880 days, they would have looked around and gone, where's Messiah? And they would have seen this road with all these people singing, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, throwing down their clothes and their cloaks and throwing down palm branches. And they would have seen their king enter into Jerusalem on that day in April in 32 AD, coming down that road, humble and riding on a donkey. And Jesus, when he came there, wept over Jerusalem. Why? Because the majority of Jerusalem did not receive him, did not recognize him. He knew the crowd that was receiving him would just, inside of a week, be shouting, crucify him, crucify him. And so he wept over Jerusalem and said, if you only had known this thy day. But now your city has been left to you desolate. When the angel Gabriel told Daniel, so you are to know and understand, he said that literally, so you are to know and understand that from the going forth of the decree, he was telling the Jewish people, you better know this day, you better mark it on your calendars. And when they did not, Jesus wept and said, if you had only known this thy day. But because they did not, it was left to them desolate. Does God hold people accountable for their lack of knowledge? Absolutely. He's made his book available. Throughout every age in history, he has made Bible teachers available. He has made people to exegete the scriptures. He has given his Holy Spirit, who Jesus said, the Spirit will teach you all things. He'll bring to your remembrance all that I said to you. We have no excuse for a lack of knowledge. And so Micah here is saying, Lord, Lord, but with a complete distance from God. A lot of people are going to be in Micah's shoes when they die and get to heaven and are feeling pretty or they get before the judgment throne of God and they're going to feel pretty confident. Well, Lord, I worship the statue of your mom. Well, Lord, I gave more than 10%. Lord, I was in church every Sunday and every Christmas at midnight. I was, you know, I did all these things. And he's going to go, you're not on the list. Jesus said in Matthew 7, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name cast out demons, and in your name perform many miracles. And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Does God hold people accountable for their lack of knowledge? Yes. Is God blessed by someone who calls on his name, who says, Lord, Lord, and yet does it in this manner? No, he's not blessed by that. It's an abomination to him. And people are actually going to stand before God believing that they were saved, thinking that they knew God. But God's going to say, I never knew you. That's the deception that religion puts on us. Religion of any sort. When we follow the traditions of man, when we follow our own inclinations, when we say, well, I know there's one true and living God, and we make an idol to him, and we put it in a shrine, and we hire a Levite to be our priest, and that way is destruction. But that is the way that seemed everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. So Micah is convinced, now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as a priest. Those words are going to be proven wrong in this next chapter. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites, this is the tribe of Dan, The tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for themselves to live in, for until that day an inheritance had not been allotted to them as a possession among the tribes of Israel. This is the second of four times that the author of Judges tells us in those days there was no king in Israel. The inference is that the author is saying there is a king in Israel now at the time I'm writing it. In those days that I'm writing about, there was no king in Israel. And we can kind of figure out about the era that the book of Judges was written, although we don't have a specific author named biblically. Historically, most people believe it was the prophet Samuel. That's validated in the Talmud. But we don't have anything biblically, and we don't have the year it was written, but we can figure out, okay, it was written during the time of the kings of Israel, which started with King Saul and ended with the captivity. But we also figure out that it was written before David was king. Because in chapter 1, we read that the Jebusites have lived with the sons of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. So at the time the author was writing, the Jebusites were in Jerusalem. You might remember that they had holed up in the stronghold of Zion and the place was impenetrable. They were saying, man, our blind people and our handicapped people could defend this against 1,000 men. You know, that we are so safe and secure up here. But in 2 Samuel 5, David, it says, conquered the Jebusites that were living safely there in the stronghold of Zion. So we figure out that it was during the days of the kings of Israel, but it was before David. So sometime during the reign of King Saul is when the book of Judges was written. And we read that it says, in those days the Danites were seeking an inheritance for themselves. And it makes it sound like, well, the Danites never got a piece of land. But that is not altogether true, because the Danites had in Joshua 19, it gets very detailed, Joshua 19, verses 39 to 48, you can read the whole boundaries in detail, the boundaries of the land of Dan that they received. But like many of the other tribes, they hadn't trusted God enough to give them the victory, and so they were oppressed. What we read in Judges 1, that the Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the valley. So just like when the half-tribe of Manasseh and Ephraim was saying, oh, there's these guys with iron chariots and there's too many trees and this and that. Well, Dan didn't get their whole piece of land because they couldn't get any of the valley because of the Amorites and just not having enough faith. So they start looking for land, and this chapter is going to describe to us that these guys from Dan that go out in search of a better piece of land. They're not content with what God gave them because it's going to require some work and some faith. They figure, okay, we need to find a better piece of land with fewer inhabitants and easier opponents, basically, because this is too tough. And let's see, verse 2. So the sons of Dan sent from their family 5 men out of their whole number, valiant men from Zorah and Eshtaol, to spy out the land and to search it. And they said to them, go, search the land. And they came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. When they were near the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young man, the Levite. And they turned aside there and said to him, who brought you here? And what are you doing in this place? And what do you have here? And he said to them, oh, thus and so has Micah done to me, and he's hired me, and I've become his priest. And they said to him, inquire of God, please, that we may know whether our way on which we are going will be prosperous. And the priest said to them, go in peace. Your way in which you are going has the Lord's approval. These 5 men from the tribe of Dan, from Zorah and Eshtaol, go out in search. They're heading north to see if they can find a better land to live in for their tribe. And they say, when they meet up with this Levite, they say, inquire of God for us. Pray to God and find out if God's leading this or not, if we're going the right way, if we're doing the right thing. And it doesn't say he spent the night in prayer. It doesn't say he went and just committed himself to God, that he went and on a fast or whatever. He said, oh yeah, you got the Lord's blessing, go for it. Man, that is evidence of a hireling. he actually admitted to being a hireling, you know, saying, oh, Micah has done this for me and he's hired me and I've become his priest. And Jesus described the difference in ministers' hearts, people who administer God to people. There's shepherds and then there's hirelings. And hirelings, well, Jesus said it better than I could. He who is a hireling and not a shepherd, he said this in John 10, who is not the owner of the sheep, beholds the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hireling and is not concerned about the sheep. He's not concerned about the sheep. When any kind of danger comes up, he's out of there. When any kind of problem arises, he's gone. He calls up his denominational supervisor, regional head, and goes, get me another church. He doesn't pray when somebody says, would you pray for me? Or, I need to know the heart of God. He doesn't tell them the heart of God. He tells them what they want to hear. And that's a hireling. You see, a shepherd will tell people the truth, even if it's not what they want to hear. Even if it might hurt a little bit. Even if it means that the sheep might get mad and go somewhere else. A shepherd will tell people the truth, even if it offends. But a hireling will do anything, will say anything to stay popular. And when he stops being popular, he's gone. He flees because he's a hireling, because he has no concern for the sheep. And so this is this Levite's heart. Inquire of God and tell us, that we may know whether our way on which we are going will be prosperous. Oh, go in peace. Your way in which you are going has the Lord's approval. Not only is the guy a hireling, he's a false prophet, because this did not have God's approval. They were just doing what was right in their own eyes. Verse 7, then the five men departed and came to Laish. Now this is headed north here. And saw the people who were living in it in security, after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure, for there was no ruler humiliating them for anything in the land. And they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone. When they came back to their brothers at Zorah and Eshtaol, their brothers said to them, what do you report? And they said, arise and let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and behold, it is very good. And will you sit still? Do not delay to go, to enter, to possess the land. When you enter, you shall come to a secure people with a spacious land, for God has given it into your hand, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth. Dan's inheritance, if you kind of picture Israel as a rectangle this way, Dan's inheritance was just south of the center. They are going all the way up to the north end to Laish. That's the northernmost point, the northernmost border here. Halfway there was the hill country of Ephraim, where they hooked up with Micah. But they see these people, the people of Laish, living in quiet security. See, they get along with everybody because they don't interact with anybody. And they're kind of self-confident, they're kind of secure because, hey, nobody bugs us and we don't bug anybody. And Dan's going, easy pickings. We can get these guys. The Lord has given them into our hands. There's the name of the Lord being used again. God has given it into your hand. Patently untrue. God had given them the land that they were living in at the time. God hadn't given them this land. But see, it was an open door. It was an easy opportunity. And the Danites, like so many of us, go, hey, an open door, it must be God's will. Hey, an easy opportunity, that must be God's direction. That must be God's leading. God must have given this into my hand. But that's not the way we need to live. See, if we go from open door to open door to open door, we can pretty much guarantee that we'll never be in God's will. Because God is not the only one that opens doors. And frankly, sometimes God gives you a couple of doors. Are you going to ask me? Are you going to see what my will is? Several years before I went into the ministry, I was sick of my boss. I was sick of my job. I was sick of the company that I worked for and everything about it. And I wanted to get out. And I'm like, Lord, please get me out of here. And that was my prayer every day. Get me out of here. I can't stand this. Maybe you have a job like that now. Please get me out of this. Well, one day I heard, I was working as an art director. One day I heard that art directors in Las Vegas were making $40,000 a year. Hey, I know someone with connections in Las Vegas. So I hopped a plane and started hitting the streets. And it only took a couple of days to land a very sweet job in one of the big casinos as an art director. Very good pay, very great benefits. All right. And see, I rationalized this all in my head. You see, God will be getting me out of this situation that I'm in. There's several really good Calvary chapels in Las Vegas, so it's not like I'm backsliding or anything. I'll finally be able to provide for my family financially the way I've always wanted to. That's a deception, by the way. And so I landed this cush job. I'm like, all right. And on the plane back, I'm reading this letter, this job offer that they typed up for me. And I started to pray. And in all honesty, I think it was the first time I prayed since I left. And I started to say, oh, God, thanks for giving me this job. And God interrupted me with an almost audible voice. And he was angry. He was angry at me. I felt a little bit like Balaam beating the donkey because God was standing in the way to kill him. And I felt God speak right into my heart. Why are you thanking me? I didn't get you this job. And if you take this job, you'll be going without me. Oh, man. As soon as I got home, I called up and turned the job down. What had it gotten me? Well, I spent a couple $100 in plane tickets, spent another few $100 on suits, taking time off work. It's pretty much a complete waste of money. It's pretty much a complete backslide, if you want to look at it that way. But I thank God that he gave me the freedom to go my own way and make that mistake, because I realized it was a major step in my life, a major learning point in my life that made me realize just because it's available doesn't mean it's God. Just because it's an open door doesn't mean the Lord has opened the door. Sometimes we can kick doors open real good just on our own. And God will allow us to get out of his will because he loves us and he won't violate our free will. Our love for him wouldn't mean anything if he never gave us a choice. You know, anybody can make a robot say, I love you, but God gives us the freedom. And you know, when I went back to that job that I hated, to that boss I was angry at every day, to the company that was just killing me, it took a while. But I learned contentment. I learned to go to work and say, thank you, God. Thank you for your provision. Thank you for putting me here. I don't know why I'm here, but I'm okay with it. And as soon as I got to that point, God called me into the ministry full time. It wasn't until I learned to be content that it was amazing. It was like within a couple of days, I'm like, finally, I'm at a place of peace. My pastor called me up and said, give your notice. I'm bringing you on staff. Okay, cool. But see, the Danites never got to the point where they were praying on the plane. They never got to the point where they said, God, is this your will? They asked the Levite, is this God's will? Is God going to prosper us? Oh, yeah, go for it. Can you imagine the judgment that must have fallen on that Levite when he died? Because as we're going to see, he was responsible for the death of many, many people. Verse 11. Then from the family of the Danites, from Zorah and from Eshtaol, 600 men armed with weapons of war set out. And they went up and camped at Kiriath Yearim in Judah. Therefore, they called that place Machane Dan to this day. Behold, it is, where am I? Behold, it is west of Kiriath Yearim. And they passed from there to the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. Then the five men who went to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their kinsmen, "Do you know that there are in these houses an ephod and household idols and a graven image and a molten image?" In other words, hey, there's $1,100 worth of stuff in here, or 1,100 pieces of silver. "Now, therefore, consider what you should do." And they turned aside there and came to the house of the young man, to the Levite, to the house of Micah, and asked him of his welfare. And the 600 men, armed with their weapons of war, who were of the sons of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. Now the five men who went to spy out the land went up and entered there and took the graven image and the ephod and household idols and the molten image, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons of war. And when these went into Micah's house and took the graven image, the ephod and household idols and the molten image, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said to him, "Be silent, put your hand over your mouth and come with us, and be to us a father and a priest. Is it better for you to be a priest to the house of one man, or to be priest to a tribe and a family in Israel?" And the priest's heart was glad, and he took the ephod and the household idols and the graven image and went among the people. Then they turned and departed and put the little ones and the livestock and the valuables in front of them. So again, we see a hireling's heart. What would you rather, be the church of one family or a whole tribe? Well, let's see, mega church. Oh, I like that idea better. No love, no loyalty. So they grab the idols. They grab the idols. They grab these images of Yahweh. Their gods can be stolen. Think about it. Would you worship a god that could be stolen? I mean, you probably recall the story about the boy who wanted a pony for Christmas, and his mom told him to pray about it. "Lord, please give me a pony for Christmas." Christmas came and went, no pony. His birthday came, his mom told him to pray about it. "Lord, please get me a pony for my birthday, please, please." His birthday came and went, no pony. The boy got smart. The next Christmas came. He was a year older, he was a year smarter. Next Christmas came. He didn't even bother asking the Lord. He went down to the local church that had made manger scene with the plastic figurines out front. Grabbed Mary, ran into his house, shoved her under the bed, said, "Lord, if you ever want to see your mother again, I better get a pony." Sorry, it's a pulpit joke. A god that can be stolen. How pitiful. How just ridiculous. Just as ridiculous as a god that is made out of a tree that half of which was burned, made out of a block of marble, half of which went on to become bathroom tile. A god that can be stolen. And a hireling who has no loyalty. Sure, I'll be the priest of a bigger church than this one, sure. So they head on out. They got their treasures. They go marching off. Verse 22, when they had gone some distance from the house of Micah, the men who were in the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house, assembled and overtook the sons of Dan. And they cried to the sons of Dan, who turned around and said to Micah, "What is the matter with you that you have assembled together?" And he said, "Well, you have taken away my gods, which I made, and the priest, and have got away. And what do I have besides? So how can you say to me, 'What is the matter with you?'" And the sons of Dan said to him, "Don't let your voice be heard among us, lest fierce men fall upon you and you lose your life with the lives of your household." So the sons of Dan went on their way. And when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. Doesn't seem like they had really a good plan, you know. Micah's like, "Come on, they stole my stuff. Let's go chase them. 600 men armed for war. What are you going to do?" "Hey, you took my stuff." come on, let's get it on. You know, never mind. You know, not really a good plan there. You took my gods, you took my priest, I don't have anything left. You know, as we go through the book of Judges, or as we've gone through a man of faith, a man that God was pleased with, a man that God had even chosen, like Gideon maybe, even a guy like Samson, if at least he was on God's side, God could have empowered him. He could have picked up a broken shard of pottery and wiped out 600 men. But God wasn't on either side. God had been excluded from this whole affair. His name had been thrown out a couple of times, but he hadn't been involved. So Micah is just half of a conflict between two really ungodly parties. God's not on either side. Verse 27, then they took what Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him and came to Laish, to a people quiet and secure, and struck them with the edge of the sword. And they burned the city with fire. And there was no one to deliver them because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. And it was in the valley, which is near Beth Rehob. And they built a city and lived in it, and they called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan, their father, who was born in Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. So these 600 men of war, along with their wives and kids and whoever else had tagged along, slaughtered these innocent people and burned the city down. Then they rebuilt it and lived there. And they renamed the city Dan. They became terrible idolaters. Verse 30, the sons of Dan set up for themselves the graven image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's graven image, which he had made all the time that the house of God was at Shiloh. Finally, the writer of Judges exposes the identity of the Levite. His name was Jonathan. He was a descendant of Gershom. Gershom was the son of Moses, actually. If you're reading King James, I think maybe New King James or New American Standard, it says Manasseh. If you're reading the NIV, it says Moses. Why is that? The reason being that it was so grievous to the Jews to think about a descendant of Moses, a direct descendant of Moses, being so steeped in sin, being such an abomination to God, being such an idolater, it was so grievous to them that when they wrote the word Moses between the M and the S, they wrote just above the M and the S a little N. And that way they preserved the record that it was from Moses, but when the rabbis would read it out loud, they would say Manasseh. It was because they were so grieved by it, that this was a direct descendant of Moses. And so that's the reason. It's not a mistake. It's not a transcription error. It's clear in our Hebrew texts. This guy was a renegade. He was idolatrous. And he was a direct descendant of Moses. And Dan's idolatry continued with Jonathan as their priest and then his sons as their priests. So we find out that although he was definitely a Kohathite because he was a descendant of Moses, he was not a priest anyway. I mean, he was not really a priest. He was just a Kohathite. They served their idolatrous temple for many years until it says, verse 30, until the day of the captivity of the land. And so it just gets worse. When every man's doing what's right in his own eyes. These are supposed to be the children of God. Micah and his mom were claiming to worship God. The Danites were inquiring, is God going to prosper us? Everybody is throwing the name of God around, and yet nobody is truly seeking the heart of God or desiring to be pleasing to God. And the really sad thing is, when we're reminded at the end of the chapter here, All this time, the house of God was at Shiloh. It was right smack in the middle of Israel. The tabernacle was up and running. God was meeting his people there. The sacrifices were being received by God. And the people at any time Micah's mom could have given her money to dedicate it to the Lord in the right way. The Danites could have inquired of the Lord in the right way. This Levite, the Kohathite, could have been serving the Lord in the right way. But everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. We need to stay true to the Lord. We need to stay true to the Word of God. Otherwise, we end up with this, where it's like, man, you think you're in the will of God, and God's going, I'm not going there with you. And that's a scary place to be. Let's go before the Lord in prayer.